I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Before we jump into the heart of the next discussion here on the Mark Steiner Show, I want to remind you to be sure to get your tickets to WEAA's first homecoming cruise. Join us for a night of fun and games at WEAA's Cotton Club Casino Fun Night Cruise aboard the Spirit of Baltimore, Thursday, October the 8th from 7 to 10 p.m., sailing from the historic Inner Harbor. Your ticket price includes dinner and a special performance from soulful jazz vocalist Gene Karn. A portion of your ticket will benefit WEAA, so don't miss the boat. Tickets are available by calling 410-727-3113 or 1-800-695-BOAT. That's 1-800-695-2628 or online at weaa.org. And there's another boat we shouldn't miss, which is the boat that has to do with the future of our planet and how we survive as a world. A book has been written. There's a new way of thinking about economy and what economics really means. We think of the economy as being based on GDP. We think of the economy being based on our industrial output and on financing banks in a certain way that's causing a huge amount of discussion in America today. There are other people who are beginning to believe that we have to begin to think about the world and our economy and how we live in very different ways. And one of those people is in the studio with us now. His name is Dr. Peter Brown. Peter Brown is a professor at McGill University's School of the Environment. He co-authored this book. He lived in Maryland, I just found out, for a while, teaching at St. John's in Annapolis and teaching University of Maryland College Park. The book is Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy, that he wrote with Jeffrey Garver. And Peter Brown's in the studio with us. And Peter, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Or jump onto Facebook and the Mark Steiner Show page and enter the discussion on this topic now. And we'll read your comments on the air or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. So let's talk first of all, obviously, about what this means, this broader sense, a right relationship with the world and a world economy. What does a right relationship mean? Because it obviously assumes we're in the wrong relationship.
Right. Well, I've been divorced twice, so I know what that's
so
all about.
Right.
Okay. Right. Okay. Well, I've also been in some real right relationships. Okay.
Me too. Right, right. I'm in one now.
Right. Me too. So right relationship is a mutually reinforcing relationship where both parties grow, or both parties, you know, their capabilities expand, their ability to deal with stress expands, their ability to imagine the future in an affirmative way expands, and you can have a right relationship with your radio station, with your university, with the planet. And we think that there's a huge evidence that our economic system is in wrong relationship with the planet, that we are dismembering the life support systems of this planet. This economic system is being held together by sort of a band-aids and string, right? By the Fed and by Secretary Geithner and the current administration. And we think it's time for a very thorough rethink of the future of life on Earth, basically for the human life and the rest of the life with which we share heritage and destiny. And that inquiry is being very carefully sidelined and blocked by the people who should be stimulating it.
That inquiry is being sidelined and blocked. So let's talk for a moment about what that inquiry is that's being sidelined and blocked, and why do you think it's being blocked?
Well, One of the amazing things about contemporary economics is that the theories of contemporary economics are right up to date with the science of January 1, 1800. Right? There's no rapprochement between these theories and the great scientific discoveries of the last 200 years of thermodynamics, of evolution, right? Of ecology, right? And of biology, right? Those are not factored in. So the economy is not conceived of as part of the Earth system, as part of the universe system even, right? So we have a set of symbols and a way of thinking that is not related in any sophisticated way at all with the planet on which it's operating.
Okay, so
and we need to have a conversation about how to straighten that mess out.
The forces at large in this world that control this world and control most nations will only institute policies that might correctly affect our well-being, whether it's in healthcare or the environment, the pollution, disease, whatever that might be, education, if it fits into their economic agenda. And they can kind of, and what we do is we have an economic model that that says it has to be, you have to have a fiscally sound definition for any policy you want to implement, mm-hmm. or else it won't be implemented.
Right.
That may be part of our problems. I mean, I'd like you to talk about, if you might, as you're doing this chapter of the book, where you talk about John Maynard Keynes and economy, mm-hmm. and Keynes, for most people who are in the progressive end of the spectrum, is like a guru of economics, of what to do to set society straight, as he tried to do during the Depression of the 1930s. The Keynesian economics is what we're talking about. So talk a bit about how you talk about him in that chapter, and both his strengths and what you see as the shortcomings of those models.
Okay, there are actually two questions here. Let me respond to this thing.
There are probably several in one time I did that.
Yeah, your first one was a question about whether to have anything advanced in our societies, it has to be fiscally sound. And I would just like to change that whole discourse and say, you know, we have to talk about budgeting, but we have to talk about the Earth's budget, right? How what the economy of the Earth is like, and we have to fit the human economy into that economy. And what we do, we live in a world of illusion, because we think somehow or other that money and budgeting of money, which is real and important, is what real wealth is about. But what we say in the book, and what I think is obvious to any biologist, that real wealth is life support capacity, right? It's the ability of green plants to turn sunlight into usable energy. And what's happening on the planet is that budget is in huge and growing deficit because of the focus on the money budget.
Right.
Okay, so that'd be my sort of first foray into your questions. Mm-hmm. But John Maynard Keynes, obviously the economic giant of the 20th century in many people's minds, including mine. Keynes was very concerned with issues of social stability. He was a delegate from Britain to the Versailles Peace Conference of 1919. He stormed out of the conference and
which
said,
"Look, end of World War II, it divided up the world after the
and World War One.
World War One, I mean
yeah,
to say.
Yeah.
I mean,
stormed out of the conference. Said, if you impose this peace settlement on the Germans, you're going to bring about mass economic disaster, very high unemployment, a dictator, and another war." He wrote that in 1919. 1939. Came true, right?
And Hitler took over in 1933 because of the economic disaster that Germany faced.
Yeah, right. A disaster of enormous proportions occurred. He wrote his main book, General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, in the mid-1930s, basically as a way of thinking about the unemployment problem so that unemployment could be dealt with without instability, basically, without riots and without political disasters such as occurred in Germany. His goal was a social system, a capitalist system that had modulated the business cycle so that you didn't get booms and busts, right? What we say in the book is Keynes is basically right. One of the chief goals of the economy is stability. But it's not just social stability. It's got to be ecological stability or ecological resilience. And for reasons I alluded to already, Keynes, when he formulated his theory, left out the world. It's an amazing oversight, right?
But we face a world, and before I get into the specifics of your book, which I'll do after the next break, that we face a world where, I heard somebody speak last night who was from Constellation Energy. It's a big energy company. They want to build a nuclear power plant in an area of Maryland called Calvert Cliffs.
Yeah, there's already one there. Right.
There's already one there. They want to build another one.
Yeah.
So, but what he was saying was, when he looked at the polling data and what people think, when you talk about why they want energy, it's because either energy is too expensive or they want it for security. That furthest down the list was global warming in terms of people's concerns or the concerns of the environment. So for argument's sake, and we'll talk more about it after the break, that let's say that you are correct, that our relationship to nature and the planet and the planet's natural rhythms, if we're not following it, we're going to destroy the Earth. But there's a leap between people's survival in this planet now and getting to a consciousness that says that's important.
Right. Right. Well, just one minor quibble. We're not going to destroy the Earth. The Earth's going to be here, right? It's going to be, we're going to destroy the life support systems on the Earth.
Yes.
And Calvert Cliffs is a great example to bring this home. I've visited there several times. A very, very interesting place, of course. If you look at the projections of sea level rise from James Hansen, the chief scientist at NASA, he says there will be 15-foot sea level rise by 2107. Okay.
100 years from now.
Yeah, 100 years, right. Roughly, right? Okay. Now, plug that into the map of Maryland, right? Plug that into Calvert Cliffs, which is a cliff, obviously, right? But you're going to see those cliffs are going to be eroding, right? Imagine if the Chesapeake Bay 15 feet higher. Imagine Baltimore with 15 feet of sea level rise. Imagine Blackwater Wildlife Refuge. You know, the whole of the Eastern Shore, Oxford, those places. I used to do a lot of sailing over there. You know, the West River also. So you're going to see, if anything like that occurs, you're going to see an entirely different map of the state, and its state's going to be a lot smaller. So what people have to do is to connect what we do today in energy supply and energy consumption with, as you put it, the rhythms of the Earth, of how the planet is operating. And we've done a very poor – Hansen, in my mind, is a real hero. I mean, he's a guy that says the hard stuff, says it clearly, says it often, and really doesn't give a damn. And I think that's really, really desirable and actually essential. But what we do, but the mainstream press doesn't want to hear about a much smaller Maryland, right? About, you know, the Baltimore Harbor basically being entirely different and with huge expenditures to retain it or it be abandoned. So we just have to wake up to the fact that we live in a physical universe, a physical world.
And I guess that's why I want to talk about the content of your book, about right. where you think we're going to go with this and how we're going right. to get to this place.
Right.
And because it's – we live in a world that's so myopic, on one level, nationalistic, separate.
Right.
In terms of our ethnic identities, our national identities.
Right.
And to think about something in a larger scale, in a larger way, is hard to get people to do because they're fearful of that for many reasons.
Yeah.
But we'll come back to all that and more. That's where we're going to go right after this break. So stay with us as we talk with Peter Brown about the book that he co-authored, Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. And we'll come back to that subject for the next half hour when we return from this very brief break to take a look at traffic and other things going on around town. I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas. This month, Urbanite goes back to school with the learning issue, featuring reports on the future of high-stakes testing, new approaches to the dropout crisis, and the challenges of teaching behind bars. Urbanite is available at over 750 locations. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We are talking with Peter Brown this hour. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 7 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. We are joined in studio right now by Dr. Peter Brown, who is professor at McGill's School of the Environment but taught here for many years in Maryland. He's co-author of the book Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. One of the people who blurbed, as we say, on his book, was in the very front of the book. It's interesting, his former president, Jimmy Carter, who wrote, "We are all stewards of the earth, but often lack specific information and advice on what we can do personally and collectively. Right Relationship provides a wonderful guide for all of us." Not a bad endorsement. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com or log on to Facebook and go to the Mark Steiner page and start the discussion there. You said something really interesting to me just a minute ago. When I said your name was familiar to me, and you said that you'd done a lot of writing on the environment and land use planning when you were here. And, you know, we can hear land use planning and people can yawn a lot. But you said you didn't realize when you were doing all this official work here in Maryland, you didn't realize how bad it really was until after you left and started doing other research. Talk about that for a minute.
Well, I think that I moved from Maryland in 1998 and started living in Montreal at the time. And since 1998 to the present, a little over 10 years, what we've learned about climate change is really dramatically improved in terms of the quality of our knowledge, but the direness of climate change and the rapidity with which it's occurring is getting worse sort of every week. You know, and where I live now in Quebec, for instance, we're having a thawing of the permafrost in northern Quebec. That permafrost holds huge amounts of methane gas, which if it gets into the atmosphere is a very efficient warmer of the planet, right? So we're getting into a situation where we have what we call positive feedback loops, where where the a process gets going, and then as the process gets going, it reinforces itself, right? So it's very likely, it seems to me, that climate change is either in or moving into a set of relationships where it's going to get worse and worse because it's getting worse and worse. And we're going to see changes in the climate of a state like Maryland and changes in the land available and the characteristics of the land that are very dramatic and that I think are probably – I mean, I don't know. I haven't looked at the Office of Planning in the last few years, but probably aren't on – you know, aren't part of the planning process now. You know, if Hansen's right and it's 15 feet of sea level rise coming in 98 years, right, this has to be taken into account in infrastructure building and planning right now.
So here we are in a world. President Obama spoke to the United Nations today. People are talking about climate change at the UN. Things are not really in a larger macro scale going at all in the direction of saving the planet. It's more like nations trying to save themselves.
Right.
And so let's talk about this search for a right relationship and what it means practically. I mean, you set it up in your chapters on the economy, and in your conclusions, very interesting about how you talk about things that are happening that give you some – should give us some hope that we can actually maybe get to the place you're talking about. But you raise the questions like, what's the economy for? How does it work? Is it too big? What's fair? How do you build – what are you talking about when you're talking about building a fair economy and an economy that works not just in the United States of America but for the world? I mean, we can barely get this one working.
Great. Well, that's a great question. One of the characteristics of the Western intellectual religious tradition is that we think fairness is only something that pertains between people. Am I treating you fairly? Am I treating the guy down the block fairly? Am I treating the person in India fairly? And what we say in the book is the concept of fairness has to be expanded very, very considerably so that we're thinking about one international fairness. We're thinking about intergenerational fairness, which we really don't think about much at all. And we're thinking about fairness between species. So human beings are taking right now about 50% of the ability of the life support capacity of the planet. We're one species out of around 15 or 20 million. We're taking half the pie. If a little kid comes into a birthday party of, let's say, 20 kids and one little boy takes half the cake, we'd say that was a naughty little boy, okay? So we're that's what we are. We're basically, right, we're hogs of the planet at this point. We're not thinking about, for the most part, not completely true, the well-being of other life forms. If you look at the, I was coming when I came. I drove up here from with a friend drove me up here from Washington. There were traffic jams on the Washington Beltway. There was a traffic jam on the Baltimore Washington Parkway. Right, there was a traffic jam virtually everywhere we went.
Yes.
Now those are, and I expect when you do your traffic reports, those are described. Those are described as inconveniences. Those are human rights violations.
What do you mean by that?
Because how we consume energy in North America is killing people now, in Africa, Bangladesh, the lower-lying portions of Asia. And we are in such a complete state of denial in this country and a complete state of unawareness, and in Canada too, unawareness of the effects of our actions, right, that we're proceeding blithely to do things that violate the most fundamental features of our religious and political and ethical heritage about respect for other persons. Do unto others you would have them do unto you. If there's somebody in India gratuitously driving a Bentley, right, or a Lincoln Town Car, and it was killing you, we would all say that was wrong, right? This person is acting irresponsibly. But we're doing that, and we're not taking that on board.
But we're saying that to have a right relationship the way you describe it,
right,
then we have to – it sounds like we're asking ourselves to give up our way of life.
Or we say in the book there are four variables you can work on, right, to get into right relationship. One of them is you can work on your ethics, right? What are your expectations about consumption? What are your expectations about conduct? I had some friends who live in Boston. The man and the woman both lived in Boston. They decided to get married. They decided, well, we'll do it in Mexico. The whole family flew down, right, for the ceremony in Mexico. 20-30 people from Boston traveled to the thing in Mexico. That we have an absurd way of life, an absurd set of expectations. The second thing we have to look at, ethics is one. Second one is population. Human population is too large. The human population in the United States is too large. The United States is headed, according to the Census Bureau, for 439 million people in 2050. Okay? You can imagine this consumption or anything like this consumption spread over another 130 million people or so, that's a global disaster. And we don't discuss the problem that the United States is overpopulated. The third area is how wealthy we are. In general, the distribution of wealth in the United States is terrible. It's very, very, very unfair. But in general, on average, Americans are too rich, right? Because that richness translates into consumption that the earth really can't handle, basically. And the last variable we've got to work with is technology. It's very important. Better use of energy, right? Better, more reliable supplies of energy, less harmful ways of getting energy. All of those are very important, but they're not going to solve the problem by themselves. They're elements of a solution. And what the Obama administration appears to be doing is putting all its eggs in the technology basket and keeping the ethics, the population, and the wealth off the table. That's a very grave disservice to the American people.
So I'm having going through the book, I mean, my question was constantly, okay, let's say I believe that fundamentally almost everything you wrote in this book is correct. That
you're a very wise and thoughtful man.
And that we don't have a right relationship with this planet. We don't have a right relationship with the earth. We don't have a right relationship with our children and their education. We don't have a right relationship with what we're doing to – you write about the exploitation of oil in Canada and Alberta with getting the sand shale out and destroying the environment there. You know, I was a kid. I played in Calvert Cliffs collecting fossils. Now it's a place to build a nuclear reactor instead. And that – So if we are out of balance with this, the question is, how do you get in balance? How do we move socially and politically and economically to this place you're talking about? Because it's not an easy place to get to. I mean, most of the world is exploited. You know, talk about oil, and we see what's happening in the Delta region of Nigeria and people being assassinated and murdered to get the oil out of Nigeria. We see what's going on in Bangladesh. We see what's happening in our own inner cities because we don't care about our own children here who are not white in America. So talk about the steps that are proactive and positive you take to deal with that
well,
you see.
Yeah, so part of one of the steps is what we're doing here this evening, right? We're talking and having a candid and wonderful conversation about having to rethink our place in the human community and in the natural community. And so part one of a movement in the right direction, we think, is what we call bearing witness, right? Of just bringing to consciousness what's actually happening and then applying to that widely held ethical standards about what's right and wrong, right? Almost all people I've known in the United States would affirm do unto others as you would have them do unto you as a fundamental moral belief. Right, and I think we can show rather easily, as I think I just have, that we don't in fact do that. So part of it is just exhibiting our behavior against simple moral standards. A second, and that's why we wrote this book, and that's why I'm here this evening to having the fun of talking with you. The second thing we think is we have to redesign our political institutions. The institutions that we have, like the nation state, like the United States, was designed in a period in which environmental change was either non-existent or very slow and very small. But now we have a situation where environmental change is very large and very rapid. And we also have a political system that is mainly in the control of the financial elite, right? We don't have a functioning democracy in the sense of, you know, really being answerable to a well-informed populace. That's just not the way it's working right now. So we think we have to move to some things in the area of governance being done at the international level with enforceable rules. So in the as you pointed out a few minutes ago, in the climate conversations, every country is trying to do the best it can for itself, but nobody's trying to do the best they can for the world. And what the European Union has been able to do is to impose some minimal labor standards, some minimal human rights standards, and some minimal environmental standards on the states, the nation states that are within it. We need to move to a system like that globally. Canada, the country where I live now, I'm very sorry to say, is a global rogue on climate. Policies are confused and non-existent, duplicitous. You know, and a country like Canada has to be brought into line with very tough economic sanctions, in my opinion. So the second stage is design. Third stage is an appeal to people in the faith communities and poor communities and urban communities, you know, that were really on a suicide track at this point in terms of a culture and a civilization. There are 150 million people in the world who live below 1 meter above sea level. There's between sea level and 1 meter, there's 150 million people. 1 meter of sea level rise is the best we can possibly hope for in this century. Those 150 million people are going to be on the move. A lot of them are going to die. But we have to face the fact that we are headed into a big disaster. And we want to be able to pull back from that. So it takes a kind of mass epiphany, mass understanding of seeking a different direction. And then we have to move toward implementing those things. There are examples of this, of people dealing with intractable situations.
When you talk about that, I mean, we only have a few minutes left here, but I part of this discussion takes place with Paul Hawkins here in Maryland on One Vision, One Maryland. And the interest in that room has to do with a vision of how we can do things very radically differently. But getting to a radically different place is a very difficult leap to make unless it's organized with people from the bottom who want to see it happen.
Right, exactly. But that's absolutely true. If you look at the people who are the architects of great change, right, in our time, who worked with people at the grassroots who wanted to see it happen, I would list Mikhail Gorbachev, right? I would list Mandela, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, obviously, all those were in the last century. But those are people who were able to take a time in history and with the support of large numbers of other people, right, to move things in a dramatically different direction with very little bloodshed. Right? And those people are the heroes, I think, of the modern period or of the current period. And what we write this book about is trying to get, to mobilize people to think about there's a better path and to get on it.
Ralph Nader's latest book is about a conspiracy of billionaires to take over the world and make it a better place.
Well, I don't qualify on that anyway.
No, I don't qualify any close to that at all. So in conclusion, if you had to kind of wrap up the kind of thinking about what you're trying to tell us, you come to a place where you talk about the European Union, you talk about the world courts, you talk about places where you think that we're moving in a certain direction that has to be emphasized.
Right.
Talk about what the direction is and how you envision us pushing it that way.
I think in part the answer is spiritual. We have to rethink our relationship with the earth, right? And that we tend to think of the earth as something we can use. You were citing examples before, take oil from here, take wood from there, take fish from there. We don't have a respectful relationship with the earth. And I think the notion of respect for the earth is something that can be kindled in almost everyone, right? And many of the world religions do a good job at that. Judeo-Christian religion doesn't do a very good job at it. Maybe that's in part why we're in the mess we're in. But I think there's a movement out there, perhaps the most influential example of it is Thomas Berry, who died a couple months ago, mm-hmm. wrote a book called The Great Work, where he talked about coming into a religious relationship with the earth, where we act in a manner that's respectful with the earth, we commune with the earth, we see the earth as a collection of subjects, we see the universe as a collection of subjects, not a collection of objects. And where we move from arrogance to humility, and we move to respect and care and love as our relationship with the planet, I think those emotions sound far out and inconceivable and so forth, but I think those are things that it's in every human breast, and that this book, hopefully, and some of the others, Paul Hawkins writes in the same general line that we do, we're trying to kindle that and to get that flame burning more brightly.
Well, I do think that it may come from the bottom up. I mean, I think that this whole movement that's taking place in Baltimore and other cities around the country at the moment, let's say the urban agricultural movement, where people are reclaiming urban land to create farms and to be part of the earth, and working with people without jobs and inner city kids who are gang members to kind of do that work, that's the beginning of changing
absolutely
a way of looking at things and bubbling up from the bottom. Yep. It has to come from bottom and top if this is going to change it anyway.
Can I mention our website?
I was going to ask you to do that.
Yeah, great. It's moral economy. steinershow.org. Moral economy, one word, .org.
And we will link to that at steinershow.org and link to moraleconomy.org and to this book, Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy by Peter Brown and Jeffrey Garver. Peter Brown has been our guest this hour. It's published by BK Books, Barrett Kohler Books from San Francisco. And we can link to that as well on our website. It's been a pleasure to meet you. When my producer, who just left us, Jessica Phillips, brought it to our attention, we said, yeah, we have to talk about this book and get it on the air. So I appreciate you being part of this program today.
Great. I enjoyed being here very much. Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about a local issue with the police and fire unions, and they're opposing what's going on in the city government here with taking furloughs. We'll talk about that when we return with leaders of all those groups. I'll remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and this hour we're going to take a look at issues facing Baltimore City and the issues facing the unions representing fire and police who are being asked to take a furlough. So we're going to talk about that this hour with our guests. Before we jump into that, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Division of Transplantation, where patients' lives are enhanced by a renowned transplant program known for innovation and excellence in kidney, liver, and pancreas treatments and transplants. For more information, call 1-800-492-5538. And we have a budget crisis facing Baltimore City. We are going to have a shortfall of at least $50 million or more, and it's growing. The state budget will be short over $1 billion more than they thought. The way the government's responding to it are layoffs, but also furloughs, they say, to keep from making these layoffs take place. But the fire and police unions say it's not in our contract, and this is not the way for us to go for public safety. We're joined in studio now by three men who represent those unions. Robert Cherry joins us once again. He's president of the Baltimore City Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge Number 3, which is the city police union. Welcome. Good to have you back. Welcome back, Bob.
Thank you, Mark.
Steve Hugate joins us for the first time in my new show here, but good to have him back. He's been a guest before, president of the Baltimore Fire Officers Local 964. Stephen, good to have you back in the studio.
Good to be here, brother.
And Henry Burris is president of the Vulcan Blazers, which represents the interests of African-American firefighters in this city. And Henry Burris, welcome. Good to have you as well.
Pleased to be here, Bob.
410-319-8888 is the number here to join this conversation. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can bring your thoughts to the airwaves. So let's talk about what's going on here. I mean, if the city is facing this huge budget shortfall and places are closing and people are being laid off and they're talking about laying off a huge number of workers in Baltimore City, and everyone is being asked to take a furlough, even though it's not in your contract, why are the fire and police unions protesting a furlough?
Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I think
Bob Cherry.
Mark, it's not that police and fire are protesting the furlough just on the basis of a contractual protection that we both have. More importantly, it's that police and fire are committed to making sure that the citizens of Baltimore remain safe. And they will not remain safe if we apply a furlough in the same way we would apply it to the non-public safety employees by removing police and fire from their patrol cars and their companies across the city of Baltimore. What isn't getting out to the public is the significant contributions that police and fire and our unions have made to assist the city in reducing this revenue shortfall of $60.2 million. Prior to Mayor Dixon and her staff meeting with the union leaders about a month or so ago, the police and fire unions took it upon themselves when we were challenged with locating some money in reference to our pension plan, and we came up with a bill, and we crafted it together with Steve Fugate and Bob Sojeski, his partner in firefighters, that by their own actuary measurement, would save the city anywhere from $5 to $7 million. Now, the mayor signed that bill last week, and that would take effect in January 2010. We need to, you know, let the public know that it's not that we're saying no just because it's a contractual. We've already begun to make some changes to the current pension plan. We have another bill that's pending that, had we not made it, would have been even more money that the city would have been short, which would have meant more furlough days or more layoffs for those brothers and sisters that are also city employees that are being hurt. Now, take that forward. Obviously, we also have a responsibility to our membership, and we believe very strongly that because of the contractual protection, that, you know, that's why it's in the contract, and we stand by it. But our priority is public safety, and that's what we want to get across to the public.
Let me digress for a moment and say, if maybe Steve Fugate or Henry Burris can explain what that deal is you cut. So what do you lose in this pension thing? How did it save $7 million?
I wouldn't characterize it as a loss. Okay. for anyone. It's somewhat of a diminution of benefit, particularly, quite frankly, for the police officers in retirement. But the long and the short of it is that what we tried to do was craft an agreement that was reflective of the typical career path of a police officer as opposed to the typical career path of a firefighter. And I have to give Bob Cherry credit, you know, for bringing his members along. Truth be told, the bulk of the savings in that agreement fell on the shoulders of the police officers in the city. But more to the point, however, you know, the easy thing for the fire locals would have been to say to Mayor Dixon, fine, let's do furloughs and let's put 16 members off duty every day, every night for the next 273 days.
Is that what it is?
Perhaps it would be more than that. That's what it is right now. It would grow, obviously, through attrition over the next 10 months. But, you know, the easy thing for us would have been to say, okay, go ahead, do that. And we would have convinced our members, you know, by hook or crook, to accept that. But it would have been with the caveat that something bad is going to happen. Something tragic is going to happen. I've been in the department for a long time, been to more than my share of funerals, and I've never had to explain to a widow that what happened to her husband, or in the case nowadays, someone's wife, that we were simply rolling the dice to make a point. We're not going to try to roll the dice to make a point. Our concern with furloughs and or layoffs is that the net result is that you have fewer police officers, firefighters, and paramedics on the street doing what we do for the citizens of Baltimore. It places the citizens of Baltimore, the taxpayers, in jeopardy, and certainly it places our members in jeopardy as well.
Henry Burris?
Well, not being privileged of the information concerning FOP and Steve and their negotiations, I cannot speak on that.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'm concerned that public safety will be affected. Just recently, I found one of my members is being exposed to being laid off. I don't know what criteria they're using, but I think there's been some false information put out about that individual.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to see that. I would hate to see subjective layoffs. I would hope that any pain felt would be equally distributed to all members in the Forest Service. I cannot speak of the police service, but as far as the Forest Service, I would hope that it's equally distributed. And from my past knowledge, it starts with junior members first. So I'm sort of surprised when I saw that a senior member of the chief staff was the first name to be laid off. And I need to address that. I won't address it here, but I will address that with city council members.
Number is 410-319-8888. Fire and police are facing either layoffs or furloughs, as many city employees are, but the police and fire locals and men and women representing those firemen, fire and police officers in our community are saying public safety will be threatened if, in fact, these furloughs take place. What are your thoughts at 410-319-8888? You may be a city employee yourself. You may work for fire or police. You may just have thoughts about what we're facing here in these budget cuts and what we all should or should not do in the face of that. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So, what happens if the furloughs don't take place and we talk about layoffs? Supposing we start seeing the layoffs of a percentage of firefighters and police officers in this community, isn't that more dangerous than a furlough?
It is, Mark. I think the second part of this is that police, I know fire just finished their negotiations, and Steve will comment on that probably in a little bit, but we start our negotiations tomorrow. And the police union is committed to working with Mayor Dixon and her administration in, as she put it, sharing the pain. We have been charged with the task of locating $5.1 million. That is roughly the estimate of the amount of police officers who would be furloughed up to 8 days. The mayor's formula that she's using is any city employee who makes under $50,000 would be furloughed for 5 days. Any city employee making between $50,000 and $100,000 would be furloughed for 8 days, and any employee making over $100,000 would be furloughed for 10 days. The majority, the median average salary for police officers, sergeants, and lieutenants fall within the category that would require us to take 8 furlough days. That equates, according to the director of finance, about $5.1 million. Without, you know, going to a lot of specifics, although the FOP has mentioned through a variety of media outlets, we are prepared and I think we are able to locate that money, which in effect gives the mayor the savings she needs but allows police and officers to remain on the street without being either furloughed or laid off. And again, this is in addition to some of the other measures that we have already taken that, had we not taken, this revenue gap would have been even greater.
So, but I guess it was so we find $5.1 million where? I mean, what does that mean? That cars don't get repaired?
No. This is coming from the police commissioner. Commissioner Bierfeld has already been charged by the administration, like all the other agency heads, to locate additional cuts in their department. The $5.1 million now rests solely on the unions in terms of salary, benefits, issues that affect us in our contract. You know, the easy way out would be just to say, as Steve said, take the furlough. You know, if we furlough every police officer in the city of Baltimore for 8 days, we, over the next 273 days, we will reach the number of $5.1 million because you're asking a police officer to stay home and not get paid. So that will be removed from their paycheck. Our argument is, not only is it contractually protected, but more importantly, you're not protecting the contract you have with the citizens of the city of Baltimore. And we cannot afford to pull police officers out of their postcards to do furloughs or layoffs. We are committed to working with Deputy Mayor Thomas Scutti and the administration of Mayor Dixon in locating the $5.1 million in our contract that protects our members, keeps them on the street, and, again, keeps the citizens safe.
Please, gentlemen, I'll pick this up. I mean, I'm curious what you would say. I mean, to let's say a person who's a garbage worker in this town, who's a sanitation worker, somebody who works with kids in the street, or somebody who does any job like that in Baltimore, they may not be in a patrol car, and they may not be jumping off a fire truck to take on a building that's burning and save lives, but they're doing critical work in this town. And the arguments you have to make to your fellow city workers why they should be furloughed and or laid off, but your department should be untouched.
Well, it's not, Mark, it's not so much a matter of remaining untouched. We've told our members from the very beginning that we're not going to get out of this unscathed. We need to cooperate with the administration and find some mechanism to absorb, in our case, in the fire department, the union locals have been charged with finding $2.9 million, which is probably percentage-wise about the same that Bob Cherry has to deal with in the FOP. Our concern, however, is that furloughs in public safety mean less people on the street doing what it is that we do for the citizens of Baltimore. And we're not going to, I certainly wouldn't minimize the role of our Brothers and Sisters in CUB and AFSCME, we work very well with Brenda Claiborne and Glenn Middleton. This is not a them versus us kind of scenario. This is simply our effort to try to find a different mechanism aside from furloughs or layoffs to achieve the savings. And contrary to some of the misinformation that's being bantied about in the media, we're not refusing to participate. We're not walking away from the table. We're very much involved in being at the table.
Where does that come from?
I would hesitate to speculate. It's certainly not coming from us. The unions are not saying that we don't want to play, that we don't want to participate, that we're going to take our ball and go home. That's simply not happening. The problem, however, again, is that furloughs and layoffs in public safety are not so easily applied as they are in other agencies. The mayor at the Board of Estimates today, the agenda item that was adopted unanimously by the Board of Estimates stipulates that for all intent and purpose, City Hall will shut down. The city of Baltimore will shut down for 5 days between October 5 and June 30. You can't shut the police department down for 5 days. You can't shut the fire department down for 5 days. There has to be some other way. And we believe, again, collaboratively, if we put our heads together, we believe we can find another way to achieve the savings without removing essential public safety employees from the street.
I'm curious what the scuttlebutt is in your shop, Henry Burris, over on Park Circle, the Vulcan Blazers, when men gather and women gather to talk about this. What are people saying about this?
Well, all my members belong to either Local 734 or 964. So they adhere to what their leaders say. I'm encouraged from what I just heard from both those presidents. My son is a retired police officer. So I'm encouraged that the leadership is trying to work with City Hall. But we have a dual purpose, the Vulcan Blazers. We're concerned about the community. We know also that any lack of fire service will impact on the community. So we have no other choice but advocate that nobody gets laid off. We know it's at a bare minimum. We had several months ago, I had to fight to prevent a closing of a firehouse because it impacted greatly in the West Baltimore area. So we're not adversaries on this. We are, of course, my membership, those who are active, are in support of the presidents of both 734 and Local 964. But the dual purpose, we're also concerned about what impact the decisions will make on the communities in which they serve.
We're talking with Henry Burris, who is president of the Vulcan Blazers, and Stephen Fugate is with us, president of the Baltimore Firefighters Local 964, representing the officers in the fire department. Robert Cherry is with us, president of the Baltimore City Fraternal Order of Police Lodge number 3, who represents the police officers in the city of Baltimore, is their union. Number here is 410-319-8888. There's a fight around furloughs and layoffs of city workers. The police and fire unions have been very clear that furloughs, they think, will endanger the city and don't want to accept furloughs, and are trying to find some other way around this. 410-319-8888. So what, I mean, so you're looking for these savings, but I'm curious what that means. Where do these savings come from? I mean, where do you save money in, we just saw the article in yesterday's Sun, or the other day's Sun, about the, as it is, all the mechanics who work for the Baltimore Police Department can't keep up with maintaining the vehicles that you all use on the street. So, I'm curious where you think these come from and where these savings come from. And I'm also very curious about the conversations that you've had. And we won't be privy to all the things you've been talking about, but the conversations you've had with the commissioner around these issues.
Well, I mean, the commissioner and his staff have worked very hard to go line by line in that budget, and despite what I think many people, Mark, in the city of Baltimore feel, it's not a an empty cup, or I don't know what term I'm trying to use here, but it's not like the money is just flowing, you know, out of the police department's budget. It takes a lot of money and a lot of resources to fight crime. And I think what we just saw last weekend is indicative of what could happen in the event that we lose those crucial resources. We had 11 shootings in a 24-hour period, three of them fatal.
Yep.
And I think it's important to keep in mind, and I think all of us at the table here agree, the priority needs to be public safety. You asked where the savings can come from. The commissioner, his staff are working on the issues that you just brought up about vehicles and some of the more administrative side of the police department. The union is charged with $5.1 million. We go into negotiations tomorrow. A savings is a savings. You know, if police and fire cannot reach that threshold of $5.1 million for police and the $2.7 million for fire, that is going to have an effect on the city's ability to keep people on the job in the non-public safety side of it. So we are doing our part. And you asked specifically, I think there's a lot of things we could still look at. Now, granted, and I'm not going to speak for fire, but I know the FOP will be ready as soon as the, you know, the economy turns around or the revenue ticks back up and the furlough plan that the mayor has in place comes to an end. We also would want whatever we have come to an agreement to also come to an end and go back to what we had previously had in our MOU or our contract. But one of the things we're looking at is, for instance, court overtime. You hear it all the time across the city about police officers. Court overtime and daily overtime is a necessity in fighting crime. An officer makes an arrest, bad guy goes to jail, the bad guy needs to come into court and hear his or her case. You have to bring the officer into court. A lot of times those officers are coming in on their days off. They're going to be paid overtime for that. The union is prepared to work with the city to, you know, if they allow our officers to take compensatory time in lieu of getting paid overtime at that point, so that that savings can be used to reduce this revenue gap. So, you know, there are ways to locate the money from the union side of it.
Let me open the phones. I have a question about the fire in a minute. Let me just open the phones. People are calling in. Let them get in here before the end of the hour. 410-319-8888. Christina, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Christina.
I'm a fan of your show.
Thank you.
My comment is I don't really understand this debate. Everybody has to pitch in. I don't see how police officers, you know, a couple police officers here taking off days, you know, everybody's not going to take off at the exact same time, as if, you know, all the police officers are going to take off, all the firefighters are going to take off at the same time, and therefore our city is going to be in danger. This argument is self-interested. We all have to give up a little something to save our city. We live in a community, and the idea that there's this huge debate that I can't not work for 8 days. I mean, hell, I'd be willing to work for free for 8 days if it kept people employed.
That's an interesting point of view. I mean, supposing people in this city continued their jobs and didn't get paid for the days they didn't work, and just to keep things going. That's a sacrifice people could make without having furloughs, without laying people off. I mean, because we could come to a point where people actually be laid off if we don't find the money. That means officers won't be furloughed. They won't have a job.
Right. Mark, let me just comment on the caller. And she does bring up some good points about, you know, you're talking about the whole sharing and why are we even having this debate. But, you know, again, that word selfish, you know, we heard that, you know, yesterday on another talk show.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very hard to believe that any police officer or firefighter or fire officer out there who puts their life on the line day in and day out, 24/7, 365 days a year, you know, is selfish. You know, I look at where we are at right now in the police department. Every night, Commissioner Bierfeld, unfortunately, is sending out 3 to 4 patrol cars short in a district across the entire city. We have 9 police districts. Now, this is just patrol. These aren't plainclothes police officers. We're looking at 3 to 4 police cars short right now. He has to fill those cars not only to make sure that our officers are safe with adequate backup, but to make sure the 911 response time to the old lady in the corner who, you know, was just assaulted gets that response. If we were to accept furlough days, let's just say police officers do not have the contractual protection of furlough. Or for that matter, let's just say, Madam Mayor, you know, even with the contractual protection, we agree, like this caller, we want to take 8 furlough days. As Steve said, we can't just shut down the entire police department and fire department on the 5 furlough days that the other city employees would take. So the mayor would have to spread it out over the 273 days. when you do the math, we have, and this is just patrol. These aren't the other 1,500 offices we have in plain clothes. Right now, there are 1,298 patrol officers who wear a uniform, are in a MART cruiser, and they're the ones that usually handle the 911. These are the officers that the public first come into contact with. If you're to furlough them just for 5 days, not even eight, you're looking at 6,490 days. That's 24 police officers a day. And if you divide it over the nine districts, that's an additional 3 to 4 police cars on top of the 3 to 4 cars we're already short. So now you're looking at, whether you live in Guilford or Roland Park or Cherry Hill or Brooklyn, 6 to 7 patrol cars short every day for the next 273 days. Do we want to take that kind of risk with our children and our elderly in the city? I say no.
That's what our listeners think. But Steve, let me, both you and Henry, jump back in here. And I'm curious. I mean, let me just throw something out at you. I mean, people ask this question all the time. Whenever they see an ambulance call in Baltimore, a fire truck goes out along with it. I mean, are there procedures like that that need to end to save money in the fire department?
Well, if you want to roll the dice, then assume that the call does not need immediate assistance, then you could put people on a call waiting. You know, you could have same day service if that's what you want to do. Yeah, you know, that's not what we do. We in the fire service respond to every emergency as though it is indeed an emergency. And if indeed when the fire truck or engine arrives in advance of the medic unit, if indeed we find out it was it's not necessary to have that type service, fine. The unit goes back in service. The medic unit handles it. God bless America. Again, we're not going to assume by virtue of a telephone call that a citizen, a taxpayer, does not need the highest level of service that we provide. The caller, the previous caller, indicated somehow that there would be massive shortfalls of police officers or firefighters every day between now and June 30 of next year. That's not the case. And what's been lost in the debate, particularly from the fire side, again, I'll leave it up to Bob Cherry to address the police side. But from the fire side, beginning July 1 of this year, we in the fire department are already operating below minimum standards. We are going through what's called rotating closures due to lack of personnel. Our overtime budget has been reduced to virtually nothing. And every day and every night in the city of Baltimore, upwards of 4 fire units are out of service for the entire shift. The average citizen probably wouldn't know that. You know, we've been very fortunate. We've kind of dodged the bullet from that point to today. But I would submit to you that that's not good public policy. That's not the way you operate a fire department, to hope that something tragic doesn't happen.
Before we turn to Andy Burns, and do you want to say anything? We've got the next caller here.
Yes, just briefly. The reason why the fire apparatus companies or stands by to the medic unit is because everybody is trained to do first aid. And they are also trained to do life-saving techniques. They are there because there's a shortage of medic units. And so they're closer to most of the incidents than the medic unit. So to prevent the delay in time for the aid, you send the nearest apparatus.
Henry Burris is a president of the Vulcan Blazers. Steve Fugate is president of Baltimore Fire's local, Fire Officers Local 964. Robert Cherry is president of the Baltimore City Fraternal Order Police Lodge, number 3, 410-319-8888. Denise in Baltimore County, you're on the air. Pardon me.
Hello.
Hi, Denise. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a little more of a comment. I live now in Baltimore County, but grew up in the city, and the majority of my family still lives in the city, and majority of them live in areas that definitely need police presence. So I, for one, am for the police officers and the fire department, and I understand them not wanting to take furlough days nor potential layoffs. It's just not even reasonable. It really bothers me that, you know, generally the areas that protect people and the services for people are the ones that, of course, are the first to be considered to, you know, not be funded or you know, funding less and things like that. And that really bothers me. And I'm wondering what other ideas for revenue are being thought of it for the city, because even if they were to get furloughed for a couple of days and or even laid off, that's not going to solve this income problem. So what ideas has the city generated? I mean, it'll be taxing businesses like large corporations that work in, you know, that are based in the city. Are we taxing maybe, you know, now that we have the cruise ships coming to the port of Baltimore, do we tax that? I mean, what are the ideas on what the city is thinking about to raise revenue? Because furloughing is not going to stop the problem. It's only if it anything, it maybe put like, you know, a quick Band-Aid on it, but it's not going to stop the economic issues. So I'm just wondering.
I don't think the leaders of the unions, ultimately with themselves, can talk about how to raise funds or taxes, but...
Yeah, I mean, Mark, first I just want to, you know, thank the caller for her support. I think that it's good to hear from those citizens and taxpayers out there who do live in the city. I myself am a taxpayer and homeowner in Baltimore City myself. I can't agree with her more. I think that we need to continue to make sure that when someone picks up 911 and they want a police officer or a firefighter, that call is treated, like Steve Fugit said, as an emergency. And God bless, you know, every police officer and firefighter across this country. We remain committed to that. In terms of raising other revenue, I think you're right, Mark. I don't know how, you know, we're obviously not speaking for the administration. I think that, unfortunately, in Baltimore City, we already have one of the largest property tax rates in the state. And these are some difficult decisions that Mayor Dixon needs to make over the next, you know, couple of years. Because let's face it, this is not going to be the first time we're discussing these cuts. I mean, I think that the governor has made it clear that, you know, his budgetary projections looking at maybe another $200 to $300 million of cuts over the next several months.
Easily.
So
I'm curious. One of the things we'll have a conversation soon is to find out how Jim Smith is managing Baltimore County so they have no layoffs, no furloughs. He's done something to keep within budget. I'm curious what that is. We'll have to ask him that question.
They have deeper pockets.
They do have deeper pockets all across the county. 410-319-8888. Jacqueline, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Jacqueline.
I'm calling to piggyback on the first caller when she said that we all have to pitch in and do our part. And my thing is they should not look at it as a furlough. They should look at it as giving back because they are blessed with a job. It's a lot of people that are out of work. Millions of people are out of work. They at least have a job. And, yes, it is. Our security is at risk, but we all have to start maintaining our neighborhoods, pitching in, doing what we can do. But we cannot just say because they're the fire department or the police department that, you know, they should not take a hit when everybody else has to take a hit as well.
Steve Fugit?
Yeah, that's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that there has to be another way, aside from furloughs or layoffs, to address the issue. You know, we're not financial experts, but we're certainly not stupid. We've all been around for a long time. We believe that, although, you know, quite frankly, there's no fat, if you will, in the fire department budget. We sat down with Chief Clack about a week ago and went line by line, took 4 hours, went line by line through the budget. There is no fat there. However, we believe that there is an alternative mechanism, much like what Bob Cherry is suggesting with the compensatory time in lieu of overtime. We believe there's an alternative method in the fire department to avoid the furloughs and or layoffs, keep our people on the street to do the job that we do for the citizens of Baltimore, but at the same time achieve that $2.9 million savings threshold that we've been charged to achieve. We believe it's doable.
And I wonder, Henry Burris, if I know how things are, I want people to hang around a place like Vulcan Blazers and creative ideas come up. What creative ideas have come out of the men and women who sit around and on their time off at the Vulcan Blazers headquarters?
Well, one of the things I don't think, and I've shared this with the chief, I think we need to approach Homeland Security. Your first responders are the police and the firefighters. Should there be any terror act or any kind of act that is needed for Homeland Security? I don't think that the administration, nor the fire department, nor the police have taken in the broad view of what Homeland Security is. And I think that each one of the different agencies should approach their senators and see if some money can be allocated to avoid the layoffs and to give them the proper far in police services to Baltimore City.
And I wonder, before we run out of time here, what the men who represent the unions think about what the prognosis is for making this work. I mean,
I guess that at the end of the day, when you know the votes are counted amongst our membership, we'll know, you know, what the result is, Mark. But I think that's
your membership has to approve anything you do.
Yes, I mean it is. I mean, what we're looking at is taking $5.1 million from the union, so it's going to come. It's going to come from a form of, you know, salary, benefits, something within the contract. Again, other than furloughs and layoffs, because we don't want to compromise public safety. Our prognosis, I mean, we're looking at it like this. As Steve said, I mean, cutting to the chase here, there's no easy way out of this. I mean, cities and towns across the country are facing the same problem. I think just recently, Mayor Nutter in Philadelphia was faced with the possibility of laying off up to maybe 900 police officers at a last-minute effort from Harrisburg. They avoided that. I think we need to do the same thing here. I don't think Baltimore City can afford, given the significant gains we've made in reducing crime and protecting our families from fires and heart attacks and so forth, to compromise on safety. That's, you know, going back, and I'll throw this philosopher out there, John Locke. You know, there are some out there who believe that the ultimate treaty between a citizen and their government is first and fundamentally public safety, and everything else from there follows after. Our job is to make sure that you wake up in the morning in a home that's still secure from a fire, and that you can go out and take your kids to school and go to work and not be accosted, robbed, shot, whatever. And we're committed to doing that.
I think Robert Cherry's had the last word for the day. We only have about 30 seconds left here, so I just want to have a very quick thought, Stephen.
Yeah, very quickly, as I often say, I'm the president of our local, but I'm not the king. Our members will determine, you know, what approach we take. We recognize and admit that we have the $2.9 million hurdle to meet, and we'll do our absolute best to do that.
Gentlemen, it's been great to have all three of you in the studio. Henry Burst, pleasure to meet you. Thank you for coming in today.
Been my pleasure.
President of Oakland Blazers. You just heard Stephen Fugit, president of Baltimore Fires Local number 964, Fire Officers Local 964. Robert Cherry is president of the Baltimore City Fraternal Order Police Lodge number 3. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the work you do for our city, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark.
Good luck to all of us. I want to remind you all to be sure to get your tickets to WEAA's first homecoming cruise. Join us for a night of fun and games at WEAA's Cotton Club Casino Fun Night Cruise aboard the Spirit of Baltimore, Thursday, October the 8th, from 7 to 10 p.m., sailing from the historic Inner Harbor. Your ticket price includes dinner and a special performance from soulful jazz vocalist Gene Karn. A portion of your ticket price will benefit WEAA, so don't miss the boat. Call 410-727-3113 or 1-800-695-BOAT. That's 1-800-695-2628, or go online at weaa.org. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. We're produced by Justin Levy, engineered by Brian Boone. Interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Christina Arison, Richard Good, and Gay Pinder. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. At Republic Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.